Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Andrew Muller. On the programme this week, we will be discussing the new rom-com, which has taken the world by the proverbial storm, Crazy Rich Asians. It's been making headlines as a film that is putting Asian cinema on the Western map. But how did it hold up for our critics? We'll be asking them very shortly. They are Tim Robey, film critic for The Telegraph, and Simran Hans, film critic for The Observer New Review, among other publications. Based on the best-selling novel by Kevin Kwan, Crazy Rich Asians follows the love story between Rachel Chu and Nick Young. Rachel, a native New Yorker, is an economics professor who has no idea that her boyfriend comes from one of the wealthiest families in Singapore. She accompanies Nick to his home country to meet his family and soon finds out that he is one of the most eligible bachelors in town, if not the continent, and there's plenty of people looking to destroy their relationship. It is a light-hearted classic rom-com story set to the ultra-bright backdrop of these ultra-rich lives. Will Rachel find her place in Nick's elite family? There is only one way to find out.
I want money.
1.2 million.
That's what I want.
The Nick you're dating is Nick Young?
Yeah, you guys know them or something?
Hells yeah. They're just the biggest developers in all of Singapore.
That's what I
Damn, Rachel. It's like the Asian Bachelor.
These people aren't just rich, they're crazy rich.
You really should have told me that you're like the Prince William of Asia.
That's ridiculous. Much more of a Harry. Mom,
this is Rachel Chu.
She just thinks you're some like unrefined banana.
No, no, no. Those are for your fingers.
Yellow on the outside, white on the inside.
Do some crazy!
Clip there from Crazy Rich Asians. Tim and Simran, welcome to the program. Tim, there has been an extraordinary amount of ballyhoo around this film. It's become one of those films that's possible to feel like you've seen it even if you haven't. And it is a rom-com, which is that most somewhat staid and staple of formats. Can you remember the last time a rom-com was this hyped?
I'd say maybe I would point to My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Nia Vardalos' film, which had this kind of similar kind of ethnic slant of being the only kind of Greek-American film of its time. This has been touted as the most fully Asian-American film since The Joy Luck Club in the mid-90s, in terms of the kind of representation, the sheer number of Asian faces on screen, etc. I think there's quite a lot more going for it beyond that. For me, the thing that it manages, which is rare in comedies these days, is that it gets funnier as it goes along rather than less funny. I think a lot of comedies start with their kind of comic premise, and then they have to sort of gradually sort of disentangle it and become kind of straight rom-com, quite dull, formulaic scenarios towards the end, whereas this is sort of the other way around. And I think it starts with like its worst scene by far and gradually picks up and kind of catches on to the idea that excessive materialism can just keep topping itself and get funnier and funnier and funnier. And by the end, I was really having a good time.
Simran, we'll talk shortly about what it means for the representation of Asians in Western cinema and for Asian cinema generally. But I want to talk about it first just as a rom-com. Does it work? Is it actually funny?
Well, I'm really glad that you are starting from that point of view, because I think so much of the discourse around this film is just overwhelmed by the diversity question. And actually, the reason why I was so excited about it is because it is a rom-com, and it's a studio rom-com, right? There hasn't really been anything of this size or scale in a really long time. I'm thinking back to things like Valentine's Day and Mother's Day. I don't know if you remember these kind of ensemble romantic comedies that are probably like 2010, 2011-ish. I mean, you'd have to double check that. But these big celebrity-laden ensemble rom-coms that really were kind of coming out on holidays and trying to court a female audience. And obviously, those films were terrible. They were so bad. They were neither romantic nor comedic. And this one manages to be both. And I think part of that is in the casting. I think one thing that we don't really know how to talk about is what makes someone a good leading man or a good leading woman. And with Henry Golding, it's in the look. He knows how to look at a love interest. He's got the smoulder down, but it's not threatening, you know? It's seductive, but it's not threatening. And that's very hard to do, actually.
Shall we explain for a minute who Henry Golding is?
Please do.
This is his first film role, and he was plucked from a job as a travel presenter in Singapore for the BBC. That's what he was doing before. And whoever was the
producer. It's quite the rags to riches story right there.
Absolutely. But they kind of hounded him, and they just said, we need this guy. He is the guy to play this role. And he was really reluctant to sort of step into acting, because it's not something he'd ever done before. And I think that you can see that he's quite a novice actor in some respects. He's not, you know, the most versatile, but he's just got an incredible resource of charm and kind of good-natured handsomeness and everything. He's kind of got it all going on, as Simran was saying. You kind of can't take your eyes off him. He's a very natural presence on screen, and he's already picked up other roles off this. He's going to become a big star. Paul Feig, the Bridesmaids director, has now cast him in two films. He's the leading man in the next one he's making, and so on. He's almost going to become the Asian Hugh Grant or something like that.
Exactly, and Hugh Grant, I think, is a nice comparison, because the flavour of masculinity that he's offering is a more kind of refined, gentlemanly, kind of debonair type of man, rather than anything that's too alpha male, anything that's too macho. Or, you know, the sort of alternative version of men that's being offered to us in a lot of rom-coms, which is a nerdy man. And I don't mean that to be unkind to nerds, who obviously deserve love too. But I think if we're thinking about rom-coms more broadly, the way they've changed in the last 10, 20 years is that they're kind of more from a male perspective. They're more bromancy, they're more comedic, they're less romantic. And so a different kind of man has been allowed to take centre stage. And I think this is a sort of nice reversion to something more traditional, but without it being kind of sexist or aggressive or scary.
Tim, you were saying before we came on air that you'd actually seen the show not at a press screening, but at a late night screening with the cinema going public. What did you glean about it from their reaction? Is it a wry chuckle kind of film, or an absolute roaring, holding sides, rolling in the aisles sort of comedy?
Oh, there are big belly laughs in there. And what I found interesting in the crowd I was at is that they were kind of factional. I could hear like one whole corner of the auditorium really loving a particular line, and then another section of the auditorium loving the next line that came along, kind of thing. And I think the script has its fair share of real zingers in there, and some really good supporting performances as well. I particularly loved Awkwafina, who we recently saw in Ocean's 8, who's kind of a rapper and actor. She's hilarious in this, and she definitely had half the auditorium in the palm of her hand, I think, in her scenes. But I thought that was the way to see the film, and I feel as though seeing it in a kind of dry press screening scenario would not have helped it very much. I should actually mention again that I do think it starts quite badly. It has this prologue set in London in 1995, where Michelle Yeoh's character is essentially sort of, they try and banish her from the hotel.
So she's Nick's mum, for context.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. She's about to take over this hotel, but they assume that she's sort of some kind of tramp and try and throw her out. And I thought the scene was really misjudged, really unconvincing, and got things off to a kind of prickly and strange start. So I was really relieved 20, 30 minutes in when the film kind of got the hold of its tone, really. And I think the way it does that is that it just starts to both revel in and undermine the insane materialism of most of these characters really, really nicely. And I did think it was very successful in topping itself with each sequence that came along after that. So you have this kind of lavish luncheon, which then is topped by an even more absurdly lavish party, and then the bachelor party on a shipping barge, which is the most insane over-the-top thing you've ever seen. But then even during that scene, there's a moment of real darkness where some of the male characters say something extremely unsavory about the female lead. And so the film does sort of dabble a little bit in challenging the kind of basis of all of this culture, and in kind of like it has a bit of a pot at the patriarchy and the matriarchy, indeed, because Michelle Yeoh's character ends up being the most formidable opponent to the lead couple, really.
Simran, it is a rom-com, and that is by now a fairly well-established benchmark template. Everybody basically knows the tropes and knows the trajectory and how it's going to work. Is it one of those rom-coms that acknowledges that, though? Are there ever any sort of either actual or implicit sort of sidelong glances to camera?
I'm not sure about that. I think it's a particular type of rom-com, right? I mean, we can differentiate here. I think it's very, very specifically a wedding movie. So rather than a traditional boy meets girl, they fall in love, there's a kind of conflict, and then they get back together at the end. I mean, there is, of course, a variation on this formula. There is a conflict and it does have, spoilers, happy ending. But it's much more about like the dynamics of the family and much more about the pageantry of the wedding and all these kind of rituals and rules and tests that she has to go through. Rachel Chu, who is played by Constance Wu. And so it's kind of less about the romance in a way and more about a kind of how she might fit into a family structure or not fit.
Tim, we should talk about the other aspect of Crazy Rich Asians, the fact that it is set in Asia with an Asian cast. And as you were saying earlier, that is still bizarrely uncommon. If you think back, you mentioned the example of the Joy Luck Club, which was obviously a long time ago now. Does it, do you think, change the idea as far as Western cinema is concerned that this is actually something that works? You know, is this a crack in a dam in that respect?
Well, what it's done is it's found a very hungry audience, especially in America, for a film with almost entirely Asian characters. And they've lapped it up. But what I'm really pleased about is that it's actually good. You know, it's not perfect, but it is good. And the film could have made a heap of money and been terrible. And that would have been really awkward to kind of witness culturally, because you would have then have had copycat films that would just get even worse. So I'm really grateful that they've kind of thought about it and actually thought about giving it moments of depth and moments of poignancy as well, alongside the quite sort of broad, slightly stereotypy humour, which sometimes they go in for, but which they pull off with quite a lot of wit. But I think it is odd that something like this has not come along for such a long time, and you do wonder why it's taken them this long to commission a film of this kind. It's strange. And I think it's like, it's encouraging, and I'm hoping that they will allow further breakout films along these lines. As Simran was saying, I like the fact that it is a kind of boy and girl rom-com, because those lately have been rare. We've had kind of all boy ones or all girl ones, if you like, Bridesmaids, etc., in which the love interests are kind of slightly tokenized. And this is not that, because it does try and give you both perspectives, both of them, and the kind of the slightly different levels they're coming in on as characters. And that again was refreshing, and I thought a really nice reworking of the formula.
And Simran, what do you think? How big a deal is that aspect of this film?
I think it's really difficult to talk about it, because on one hand, yes, it is great, and like the fact that the film has made so much money and has been so commercially successful sets a really useful precedent for other kind of majority Asian cast films. But also, I'm loath to kind of frame it in purely those terms, because I feel like the fact that it's successful in terms of its diversity is secondary to the film. I think how amazing that a studio rom-com format has been reinvigorated after such a hiatus, and even better that it's got a cast of all Asian actors. But I think it's not the only thing it has going for it, you know?
I mean, Tim, how sure-footed do you think its translation of Singapore in particular to an American audience has been?
I mean, it's certainly gone down pretty well, but I think it hits a lot of very successful comic buttons, and it knows how to revel in, but also critique the Singaporean excess. It ends with a spectacular and very economical finale, which I think is one of the best endings of a rom-com I've ever seen.
But can I say on the ending, and it's not really a spoiler because I won't describe it too much, but the shot is a kind of crane shot that one of my friends said to me reminded him of the last shot in David Fincher's The Game, which, you know, look out for it, you know, if you go and see it.
That's a nice point, actually. But yeah, I mean, it kind of parodies itself at the end, because it enables this situation where you're not sure if the main couple are actually going to get hitched or not. And then there's the sort of resolution of sorts. And then it just hastens itself into the most ridiculous over-the-top party on the spur of the moment you can possibly imagine. And the idea being that these characters, or certainly the parents and the kind of the dynasties they're coming from, have such an exorbitant amount of wealth, they can just at the drop of the hat create the biggest party on earth with hours to do it. And I just thought that was a really nice way of wrapping up all the storylines, and also, like I say, topping everything else it had been saying and doing. So that I really enjoyed, and I think it kind of brings the audience out on a big high. And I was just sort of laughing at the film's like over the top showmanship in that respect. And yeah, you can kind of see it as a bit of a fantasy land kind of, is this real situation, if that's what you want to do with your Fincher comparison? Is this in fact an absurd, ridiculous, out of this world moment? But yeah, I mean, there's many levels you can take it on.
Well, I think I'm perhaps a little bit more cynically minded towards its representation of Singapore. Not that I visited, although I do have friends who live there. I think it just seems very, very glossy. And I know that's kind of part of the charm of the film, but almost as though it's an advert for Singapore, right? Almost as though it's tourist board approved. There are these great scenes of them like in the market eating. I mean, this as well, it should be said, is a film about food. The attention to detail in what they eat will make you hungry. So be warned.
I like the food. I wanted to be eating that food. But then there is, alongside the kind of touristy stuff, there are quite shocking moments. There's a moment where a bloodied fish is thrown into the hotel suite of Constance, and it tells her to she's a gold digging bitch basically. There's blood sprayed across the wall. She's told to go home in no uncertain terms. It's quite a brutally dark moment for a rom-com. Think of the last rom-com with something that horrible happening in it with such malice behind it to one of the main characters.
Which I guess brings us along to looking at the other world it represents to a mainstream audience, which is not the world of Asia or Singapore, but the world of the super rich. It's an insight, or at least a representation of that cruelly marginalized and misunderstood group as well. How does it handle that? Because you with a rom-com especially, you still want the audience to like the characters, or you want the audience to like some of the people in it and hope that their dreams come true and that their ending is a happy one. How does it go about encouraging, sympathy or affection for people with bottomless pits of money?
I mean, there's like a sliding scale of heroes and villains of the rich people. But I think the film's attitude is kind of, it's very American, you know. Rachel Chu is an American professor coming from New York who's got a single mother and has had a working class upbringing, and she's an academic, and then she comes over and we see Singapore and its wealth through her eyes. It's kind of a sort of American dream style look at wealth and this idea that you should really work hard for it, and that inherited wealth is something to be a bit more suspicious of. But I think maybe it's more generous towards people who have a lot of money. And I guess what it does that's clever is that it makes a distinction between old money and new money. So you have the Awkwafina character as one of Rachel's school friends, and she's insanely rich also, but her family are presented as kind of tacky and they're not invited to all of the things. And you know, you kind of get to see the class distinctions between Nick's family, who are a dynasty, and how they're perceived by the rest of the people in their community. So I think it kind of looks at that tension.
There's a nice jump or a nice contrast between the nouveau riche family, whose kind of McMansion is the most gleefully tacky thing you've ever seen. But then as soon as the name of Nick's dynasty is mentioned to them, their jaws drop and they're like, what, you're going to that? Oh my God, where do they live? I need to see their mansion. And the kind of desperation of the nouveau riche characters to kind of get hold of what the dynasty have is really palpable. I thought there were plenty of funny notes there. And I think in terms of sympathy, what it does is that it makes Nick a character who's very embarrassed about his wealth and ultimately doesn't care about it nearly as much as the rest of his family and is not determined to become the heir to the fortune and so on and so on. He genuinely just wants to be happy. So that's another kind of classic rom-com formula, the kind of prince and the pauper type situation. In fact, we're going to talk about Cinderella films, aren't we?
Well,
because that's also
moving,
part of this.
Well,
yeah.
Moving seamlessly along, we do like to broaden the discussion by asking our guests about references or associations they had for this film. And for you, Tim, this was the classic Cinderella rags-to-riches story that rom-coms do rely on. Do you think Hollywood will ever get tired of it?
Hollywood loves a Cinderella story, there's no doubt. I mean, they often do a really bad job of them, to be honest. I mean, there are many, many versions of Cinderella, whether or not they have Cinderella in the name or not. in the 90s, sort of every film that Drew Barrymore was making was essentially a Cinderella rom-com, from Ever After to Never Being Kissed and so on. Beyond that, you know, J-Lo did one called Made in Manhattan, and she was a housemaid who Ralph Fiennes is kind of uber-rich senator or whatever he is, doesn't realise is the help. And again, there's always that moment, the kind of 11th hour moment where the... you know, that the slipper falls off and she has to go home. And in this film, that's done in probably the most awkward, dramatic way in the film. The scene doesn't quite work. It turns out that Rachel doesn't realise what happened to her dad and that she's sort of been accidentally peddling an untrue version of her own backstory, which is found out about. And she's sort of banished from the clan and sent packing. But then we retain total sympathy with her, because what we don't realise is that she doesn't know either. That's just the latest variation on the kind of classic moment of, you know, you've got to go home now because you don't belong with us. You're not one of us. And that's what Michelle Yeoh's character says to her as well. She says, you're not us. You're not our people. So she has a big battle on her hands to overcome the evil stepmother character, as it were, mother-in-law character. But I do think that the power of the mother-in-law in the kind of Asian marriage context gives it extra charge here, because obviously there are, you know, this is a powerful figure in the culture, and making her into the kind of main antagonist of the film does actually work. She's a great evil stepmom, given a new transplant, basically. Yeah.
I mean, as you point out, it's a thing that Hollywood does time and time again, and will doubtless do time and time again more. Do you have any particular favourites or non-favourites? What's the secret to getting the Cinderella story right?
I think one of my favourite non-favourites, if you like, would probably be She's All That, which was one of the spate of high school rom-coms in the 90s, where Rachel Lee Cook's character is the kind of downtrodden, allegedly not pretty girl who kind of dolls up for the day and suddenly gets to go out with the hottest jock in school, Freddie Prinze Jr. And that film is so unbelievably synthetic and silly that I couldn't really give it the time of day. It has the notorious scene where she kind of comes downstairs and everyone's like, "You're actually hot, oh my goodness," because she's taken off her glasses, you know. Absolutely notorious and very, very superficial, and didn't really kind of...
When she took her glasses off, did she do the waving her hair out in slow motion thing as well?
It's very much like
because that's very important.
It's very much like that. A film made no effort to put her on a kind of lower socioeconomic stratum to anyone else. That's the key. Whereas this film does make quite a lot of effort to do that, and it gives her quite a sort of major and kind of significant backstory. So I just think they've worked it out in the script better here. And this is one of the best Cinderella films I can think of for quite a long time. I have to admit, I think Hollywood tends to screw up the Cinderella stories more often than get them right.
I have to say my problematic favourite is Pretty Woman.
I hear that from a lot of people, that this is their problematic favourite. I mean, I don't think we need to spend too long discussing why it's problematic, but why is it your favourite?
Well, I mean, look, we don't need to get into the kind of sexual politics of that film, which don't sit comfortably now watching it in 2018. But I think the chemistry...
I thought they were a bit rickety at the time, to be honest.
Well, it was a little bit before my time. But Julia Roberts and Richard Gere have incredible old-school romantic comedy chemistry. And also, I think, like, you know, in this genre or subgenre of films, my favourite thing is the makeover, the transformation. And you get to see Constance Wu being kind of glammed up in these gorgeous gowns and, you know... she gets to have makeovers by her friends, and I think there's something very kind of like wish fulfillment about that, when she walks into the party and everybody's heads turn and they're, "Who's that? What is she wearing?" And you know, I think there's something very satisfying about that.
Yeah, I love that the makeover is also one of her main kind of weapons in trying to essentially beat Michelle Yeoh at her own game. She has to doll herself up and kind of like become victorious over the unbelievably glamorous mother-in-law to be.
Pretty Woman, your problematic favourite, is there one that exists in your head as the how not to do the Cinderella story? Well, you could answer Pretty Woman again, of course.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is with these classic stories is that they're told so many times that it can become tiresome. And what makes them fresh or interesting is often down to the acting and the chemistry and the screen presence. So I think that's why in Crazy Rich Asians it lands, because they just have this presence, the two lead actors, that makes you carry on watching, even if you know what's going to happen, even if you're familiar with the arc.
Well, on the subject of classic stories, well-worn templates, etc., this got you thinking about other classic love stories, Pride and Prejudice in particular, which has been done several times on screen. Do you have a, which one of them do you think has worked best so far?
I like the BBC version with Colin Firth the best. But, you know, I'm also quite into the Keira Knightley version by Joe Wright. I think that's underrated.
I mean, I like it too.
How good of you to come.
So which of the painted peacocks is our Mr. Bingley?
Well, he's on the right and on the left is his sister.
And the person with the quizzical brow?
That is his good friend, Mr. Darcy.
It's miserable, poor soul.
Miserable he may be, but poor he most certainly is not.
Tell me.
£10,000 a year, and he owns half of Derbyshire.
The miserable half.
Pride and Prejudice there. What worked for you about that variation of it?
Well, I think when you think about something like Pride and Prejudice, the classic Jane Austen story, the updated romantic comedy versions of it tend to be things that focus on the dynamic between Elizabeth and Darcy and the sort of tenseness and the intellectual kind of riffing and the banter between the two of them and the withholding as well. And so something like Bridget Jones's Diary is a sort of remake of that in a way. But what I thought, you know, reminded me of it in Crazy Rich Asians was the family stuff, the class angle, the fact that it's all about this mother thinking about marriageability and, you know, a kind of new figure coming into an existing community. And I guess it's gender swapped in this sense because for Michelle Yeoh, it's like her son who's coming in and he's the kind of eligible one that needs to find the right match. And that is not the Constance Wu character. But I think in terms of the kind of the micro relationships and how all of the cousins and the siblings and the sort of the grandmothers and how they all relate to each other and how they all prickle at the slightest interruption to what they're used to and what the status quo is, I think that is what the connection was for me.
But do you think the Pride and Prejudice dynamic, and you mentioned the update via Helen Fielding's books to the Bridget Jones movies, is actually timeless, or is Pride and Prejudice inextricably wedded to the period in which it's set?
I think there is a timeless element to it. And, you know, I'd sort of remind everybody of Gurinder Chadha's remake of it, Bride and Prejudice, which was a musical version of it. I have my reservations with that film. I don't think it's perfect by any means, but I think it's very funny and it's a very clever riff on the material because in Indian families specifically, this idea of eligibility, marriageability, you know, dynamics between families, extended families, weddings, the theatre of it all, and the controlling mother. These are all tropes that very much exist. And so seeing this in Crazy Rich Asians, I think in sort of non-Western communities, the hierarchies are slightly different. And it's a really kind of funny way of connecting these two different cultures from two different times.
Well, just a final thought then, as we are coming to the end of our time. I guess I know the answer to this question in advance, but I'll ask you first, Simran. Crazy Rich Asians, this is a hearty recommendation from you, presumably.
I really like this film. I think it's silly, I think it's shallow, I think it's very funny, and it just makes you feel good. I can't remember the last time I went to a movie and felt great coming out of it. Yes, maybe I've been provoked, or maybe I've been scared, or I've had adrenaline coursing through my veins, but this one made me feel on a total sugar high, and I think if that's what you're in the mood for, go and see this film.
And Tim?
Yeah, I was about to say sugar high. It's like mainlining sugar and then champagne and then more sugar and then more champagne and then a magnum of champagne. It's really fun. Gets you drunk.
That celebratory note brings us to the end of today's show. Crazy Rich Asians is out in cinemas worldwide now, as you may have heard. Thanks to my guests today, Simran Hans and Tim Roby, and to my producer, Holly Fisher. Join us at the same time next week, but for now, from me, Andrew Muller, thank you for listening.